Okay.
Sorry about that. I forgot you're on the recording.
Well, that can be exciting.
Oh, well.
Big Brother is watching.
So the thing is here that this File Explorer by default is using a sans serif font, so you can't really see in this particular font. I don't really see any difference between lowercase l and capital I. However, if I take Jocelyn sent me some files. So if I take Jocelyn's files and write the file names into a spreadsheet and blow them up and make them into book and tico, which is a serif font, which Chris loves. You'll see that actually the sixes begin with a capital I and the fives begin with a capital I. And yet we still have the sixes coming before the fives. So then I thought, well, why don't we have a look at it in DOS? So it turns out that there are different rules. And if you look at the listing in DOS, meeting is being recorded. Very good. If you look at the listing in DOS, then in addition to Jocelyn's files, I added a file called a.txt and one called z.txt. So I can clearly see the sort order is ascending. But I've got the five series coming before the six. And yet, in Windows, in File Explorer, A and Z are in the right place, but now the sixes are coming before the fives. So Chris pointed out, this was a joint effort, by the way, Chris pointed out that it's really strange the way that File Explorer is dealing with numeric sorting. If it sees numbers, normally it will sort them before alpha. And it certainly does that when the number's at the front. So, for example, if I create a file called ilcat5, it comes before ilcat6. And 50 comes before 60. But I've still got this 6A thing coming before the 50 series. And so when the alphabetic character is in the middle of the file name, then somehow that's taking precedence. So Mr. Google knows the answer to everything. And if you ask the right question, you'll find the right answer. And it turns out that there are two different ways of sorting in File Explorer. They call it numerical sorting. So by default, you have numerical sorting enabled. And if it's disabled, you get a different set of, a different display. So basically what happens is if you get a big number, then that comes before anything else because the thing's being sorted, quote, numerically. Well, it turns out you can disable this. Now, there's good news and bad news. And for me, it's bad news and bad news. Because the first way to do it is using a group policy. But group policy only exists on things like Windows 10 Pro or the enterprise type editions. And since I have Windows Home, then I can't do that. Now, the other way to do it is to use a reg file. So in other words, you've got to edit the registry. And you've got to change some D words and that kind of stuff. And while that's possible, to me it's a lot of hassle. But you can do it if it really needs to. So Chris thought, well, he thought this was really strange that you would do that. And, you know, so that Paris, 1,000, if you had photos, and you had them labeled like number 6, number 12, number 9, then that and the numbers are in the middle of the string, the file name. But if you kind of see a series of photos and you read that directory display, it kind of makes sense. Because otherwise it would do it like this, and then that basically mixes up the numbers. And Jocelyn pointed out that he actually doesn't do that. He kind of pads the numbers, and I do the same thing. So I'd said, really the better way to do it is just to name your files, I could say, properly, so that you just pad the six out with zeros and with four digits, you can get the image files listed in the correct order. And I normally do this by, you know, you normally get these IMG 2069 53, you know, a whole bunch of numbers. I always renumber them using a batch file renamer and give it a template, and then it just fills in the numbers from 1 to 1,000. So I would end up with a series like this for any photos that I use. However, that's the basic answer, that if you look at the files in File Explorer by default, it will try and arrange them like this, so that the biggest numbers come at the end, sort of thing. And if you want to change that, then as I say, you have to edit the registry or do something else.
Maybe just a little note, in order to change that policy, you need to have a Windows 10 Pro if you want to use a group policy editor. So just for a little comment.
Or the Enterprise Edition or the Education Edition, apparently.
But it is it is a pretty simple registry edit. You can do it manually. You don't have to use a reg file. It is a pretty simple registry change.
Anyway, thought it was kind of interesting that you got three members of the board of directors and none of us had noticed that File Explorer does that before.
Well, I never use File Explorer is my excuse. Although I might not have noticed it anyways, but I never use File Explorer. Tom had a question. Can you choose the font for File Explorer? I don't believe you can. I'm not sure.
Know. I don't use File Explorer very much either.
Yeah. And Jan asks, what batch file renamer do you like?
Because I'm using it on images, I use Fastone Image Viewer, which has a bunch of editing capabilities. One of them is batch file convert, so you can change the size. Another one is batch file rename, so you can basically name the images along these lines. Fastone Image Viewer.
The Windows Power Toys has a batch renamer as well. So if you install those, there's a whole bunch of tools in the Power Toys. If you go back into previous Q&A, you will find a presentation or two that includes some stuff on some of the Power Toys, as well as some old newsletters. I've written articles on various Power Toys, and I haven't written one specifically on the file renamer, but there is one built into them.
Yeah, and there's lots of other you as well.
Yeah.
Now, one application that Chris has shown quite a few times is called Total Commander. And it has a very good batch file renamer in it as well.
Yep.
For what it's worth for photos, I myself prefer to keep the number that the camera has given it and then just add in the an ID for the camera and any other information later on in the file. And that way you always have a kind of a link back to the most original.
Okay, I don't see any other questions. Oh, Alan's frozen again. He's gone. Okay, let me see if I can find the deck, and I'll continue on with it until Alan gets back. I think if I can find the deck.
We've reached the end, according to the email.
No, there is actually a little bit more, so... Let me go, and if Alan shows up, people can scream out at me and let me know that he's back. But until then, I will take over the deck. Oh, crap. Almost there. Okay, there was a question about router configuration. And a couple of questions that came in, and some functionality that was enabled on this person's router, universal plug and play, and they had a question, is this an avenue for malware to come into your system? Digital Living Network Alliance, DLNA, and he said that seemed to be for sharing storage that you plug into the router to all devices on your network, and Session Initiation Protocol, or SIP, and which seems to be for VoIP phones, and he was wondering, should all this stuff be turned off? Well, I know a little bit about one of them. So first thing I'll say is the first rule of IT security says if you don't need it, disable it or remove it, because if it's not on your computer, it can't be exploited if a vulnerability is found in it. So that's a good first rule, but sometimes it's not practical to really go and disable or remove everything that you're not using. So if we look at universal plug and play, I've read a little bit about this, and yes, there's been vulnerabilities that have been found in universal plug and play. Some of them have been patched. Some of them, I believe, remain to this day. But everything that I've read on universal plug and play says that if your router is properly configured, that you're not allowing incoming traffic from the internet, it's not really a problem because it can really only be exploited by a device that is on your own network. And if you have a device on your network that has already been exploited such that a bad guy can use it to play around with universal plug and play, well, you've already got a bigger problem than universal plug and play. You've got a compromised computer on your network. Now, I suppose there is a chance that somehow somebody could, you know, through some kind of vulnerability, attack your router even though it's not visible on the internet. The likelihood of that happening, I think, is pretty low. You know, if you are in really what is known as stealth mode, where from the internet, your network doesn't even show up on the internet at all, the likelihood of a compromise, I think, is like really, really low. So for me, I think universal plug and play, I don't really care. If you know you don't need it, then sure, turn it off. Usually what it's used for is that it allows for computers that are on your network to open certain ports on your router automatically for specific programs to function properly. So it will allow in traffic on a very narrow basis for some particular program to work properly. I don't personally use any of those programs, so for me, turning off universal plug and play is, you know, it's not really a big deal. But to me, it's not a big deal if I leave it enabled either. But does anybody have a different take on UPnP that they want to chime in and say whether they think it's wonderful or terrible? Tom, if you're talking, you're muted.
My understanding of universal plug and play is that it's for kind of easily attaching things to your router. And if you're attaching them physically, you don't need it. If you're attaching them through Wi-Fi, then when you use universal plug and play, you have to actually have them nearby, and you sort of turn it on and turn it off. But the only way it can be exploited is my understanding is if somebody else at the same time tries to connect up their Wi-Fi to some router and they happen to pick yours by accident. So all the suggestions I've seen say don't use it. The only reason to have it is for very short periods of time, and they don't save you much time or effort because all it does is it automatically put in the password to your Wi-Fi router for your particular Wi-Fi thing, and it's not that hard to do manually.
Yeah, I don't think it is actually a huge problem, but as Tom says and as I said, if you don't need it, why bother having it there as a potential problem for the future? So anybody else got an opinion on it? Okay, we'll move on. So Digital Living Network Alliance. Now we get into stuff that personally I think is a little bit trickier. I did a little bit of reading on it. It seems to be much more than just sharing media through your router. For example, I believe that Rogers requires it if you're using their Ignite service, where you get TV service as well as internet access and home phone and things like that. So I believe that it's needed to be enabled. It was enabled by default on my Ignite router, and I haven't turned it off. I suppose I could turn it off at some point, test it, and see if all of a sudden my TV service drops. But unless you really know that for sure you don't need it, you could end up potentially with some issues where some kind of services all of a sudden stop working. I guess turning it off and then seeing it, if everything you need still continues to work properly, that might be okay. But if all of a sudden 2 months down the line something isn't working right, will you remember that, oh, I wonder if it's that I turned off DLNA 2 months ago and now it's just popped up and it's causing a problem on it. I looked for vulnerabilities in DLNA, and I didn't find anything that popped out as being a particular issue or anything like that. But this, I've done very little looking at that. So does anybody else have any experience at all with DLNA, whether it's needed, what it's used for, and whether it can be safely turned off? And I don't hear any voices, so I think we'll move on. The last one is Session Initiation Protocol, or SIP, and that definitely is about voice over IP. And the danger I see of turning off SIP is that just about any home phone service now probably requires it, including Bell. Like if you get their Bell 5 service and your actual phone service is probably been switched over to voice over IP. I'm not 100% sure, but I'd be willing to bet that, you know, it uses voice over IP. I know that Rogers, I've got, you know, home phone, they threw it in with my package for free, so why not? But it uses voice over IP, and so I presume it also requires SIP. Does anybody on the call understand voice over IP much better than I? Well, everybody understands it much better than I do. But does anybody know it to the extent that you know whether SIP is required for all voice over IP and whether all home phone service requires it now? Mr. Walker, I think you have done a bunch of work with IP phones and things like that. Do you have any knowledge on this?
Not really, no. Yeah. It's not something you have to set up to set up your VoIP telephone service, so I can't really say that I'm familiar with this at all.
Yeah. I would also think that because it's used more and more and more now, that if it was a problem, there would be more indications out there than I've seen. I haven't seen a lot of issues with SIP as being something that, oh, yeah, make sure you turn this off. So personally, again, it's one of those things that if you absolutely know you don't need it, you might be able to turn it off. But when you're trying to troubleshoot a problem a year down the line and you remember that you turned off SIP. So personally, I think on something like that, I would just leave it enabled myself and not have to worry about troubleshooting a problem down the road. Just my opinion on that. Anybody else with opinions on SIP?
Main problem with SIP is scammers using it.
How so?
Because they, by using voice over IP, you can fake whatever number you're calling from.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
So it's on the other end.
Yeah. There's nothing really you can do to prevent that.
Yeah, no. I'm afraid the phone system needs a lot more security work.
Yeah.
Chris, Martin's asking if your Rogers phone quality is similar to that you had with Bell Landline.
I find that the quality of Rogers' home phone has been quite good, certainly better than Cell. And Alan, you are co-host again if you want it. I found that the quality of the phone is certainly better than my mobile. I hate mobile phones for their quality. They're getting better, I find, but still I find that my home phone service, I have no qualms at all about the quality of it over Rogers. Anybody else?
Just a point on the quality. Being out here in rural Ottawa, My Bell landline service was absolutely terrible, and it was so noisy at times I had to ask friends to call me back on my cell. So that when I changed to VoIP, the calls now are all crisp, clear, very smooth.
Yeah, I haven't heard people complain about quality on voice over IP. Federal government went to voice over IP pretty much their entire federal government, and quality, they, as far as I know, they had no questions about people complaining about quality of the service or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, for what one point about people using SIP as well to spoof the caller ID is that the at least the major phone companies have the ability to block that, but they don't seem to want to do it. So unless the government mandates it, because a lot of these scam callers and all that, they're using phone services that they're paying for, and so the big companies don't want to cut them off. Don't have any incentive to cut them off.
Right.
For what it's worth, SIP can you use it with a variety of programs, especially on Unix, to actually create a phone number and make calls with it, or even to make calls without a phone number. But you don't need it for things like Skype or Zoom or other. Right. That are very much more internet based. They don't use the SIP protocol.
Yeah. Okay. I think we can move on and let's see what we're at here. Okay, over to you, Alan.
Well, why don't you just drive the slide? Because I probably dropped my connection again.
Yep. Fun facts is up on the screen. So.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of interesting. People probably know about it, but. The big internet companies that use these hyperscale data centers with 250,000 servers, and they don't use the same PC that you and I use. They strip everything down to the bare bones. So, for example, there's no video card, there's no video connectors, because they don't have any displays on their servers. And they're trying to save electricity, basically. Some of these guys have a £3 million electricity bill. And the one I really like here is that they don't have any blinking lights. And they don't have any blinking lights because in a data center, there's nobody there to look at them. So you want to get the rest of the information, there's the link to an article in January's Physics World. It's available on the web.
Okay. So we are over time, but if there are any other questions, comments, or shares, well, not shares, but any questions, last little bit before we do our wrap-up slides.
There was a question right at the front end. Michelin was asking what the features of the new Windows 10 are going to be. And she's alluding to an article from the CEO who was saying that it's going to be the greatest Windows ever, but he didn't actually say what the features were, and I don't know that anybody outside of Microsoft actually knows.
Yeah, I think you're right. Satya Nadella was at Build, I guess, this week, and he alluded to it, just saying it was going to be really, really great, but nothing.
I thought XP was the greatest Windows ever.
Well, at the time it was, yeah. Now it's just a piece of crap.
One thing, the information about the USB standards that is in whichever YouTube was up may have missed today's news.
Oh, yeah.
There's a USB standard that's supposed to support 240 volts.
No, watts.
Watts.
Watts. Thank you. I was wondering if it was a clothes dryer supported.
And the current high end is 100 watt. And so that's a huge increase in the amount of power that you're able to pump over USB with the new standard. Yeah. That's incredible.
Maybe charge a Tesla or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Thick enough cable.
Yeah. Okay, I think we'll go through our final slides. So the upcoming Tech Cafe is on Monday, June 7th, and our own Lawrence Patterson will be talking about the reducing the anxiety managing your passwords using password phrasing. So if you have issues with concern over your passwords, come on out for that, 4 p.m. on Monday, June 7th. You do have to register through the Ottawa Public Library. They use Eventbrite for their scheduling part of it, and you will get an email if you register for it with the link that you need to join up. And our next main presentation for the OPCUG is Wednesday, June 9th, and it will be Origins of EdTech or Education Technology from Mariana Cortez, and she's coming in from Miami, and she's the CEO of the project One Laptop Per Child. And so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's a lot about third world in particular, making sure that kids get the resources they need to actually get into the information age. So that promises to be a very interesting presentation. So if you have something for next week, by all means, send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca. And with that, I think we will wrap it up for today. And the next Q&A, of course, is next week, June 2nd. So hope to see you all then. And with that, I will stop the share.
Stop the recording.
Stop the recording. Yeah, we didn't get much recorded this time. My apologies. Fire me.